This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib, coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
In the spirit of national unity, forgiveness and dialogue, I'm asking you, the people of South Sudan, to forgive me. I read this sentence again. I said, I'm asking you, the people of South Sudan, to forgive me for any mistakes I might have committed.
That's South Sudan President Salva Kiir speaking in Juba today. Details coming up.
Also, West African leaders will meet Saturday on Gambia's election crisis, and the Islamic State claims responsibility for Sunday's suicide bombing of a Coptic Christian church in Cairo.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, West African leaders will meet Saturday on Gambia's election crisis. Four West African presidents visited the Gambia yesterday and met with President Yahya Jammeh. They will now brief members of ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States, on the political situation. President Jammeh initially conceded defeat in the December 1st election to challenger Adama Barrow. However, he later announced he would challenge the results in the Supreme Court. Barrow has called on Jammeh to step down when his term expires next month. The new Secretary General of the UN, Antonio Guterres, has called on Jammeh's refusal to leave office and the police blockade of the elections office an outrageous act of disrespect.
The Voice of America, VOA.
South Sudan President Salva Kiir has issued a qualified apology to the Sudanese people today, asking their forgiveness for any mistakes he might have committed. Kiir made the remark during a speech today in Juba. He also ordered government forces to observe a ceasefire and create a conducive environment for communities to reconcile. Tito Justin reports from Juba.
A police band plays as President Kiir approaches the podium at Juba's National Legislative Assembly building, where he delivered his end-of-year address. During the speech, Mr. Kiir asked citizens for their forgiveness.
In the spirit of national unity, forgiveness, and dialogue, I'm asking you, the people of South Sudan, to forgive me. I read this sentence again. I said, I'm asking you, the people of South Sudan, to forgive me for any mistakes I might have committed. This is the spirit that our country needs, and we must act now. I pledge to all of you, fellow citizens, that the new year dawns on us. I will leave no stone unturned in the search for peace, reconciliation, and unity in our great country.
The president says the national dialogue should include people from all sectors of society as the country's three-year-long conflict drags on.
I strongly believe that the current situation in our country calls for a national dialogue. It calls for unity and an end to the cycle of violence and atrocities. National dialogue, in my view, is both a forum and process through which the people of South Sudan can gather to redefine the basis of their unity as it relates to nationhood, citizenship, and a sense of belonging.
President Kiir says a national dialogue will allow South Sudanese to openly discuss how the country should be structured and what the development priorities should be. He says the government will ensure the dialogue is credible, genuine, and open to all South Sudanese people, and that its outcome will be accepted by all and implemented.
To achieve this, I am throwing the full weight of your government behind it. But the government will not lead or control this process. The government shall be a stakeholder in the national dialogue. I strongly believe in South Sudanese-led process, and so we have identified our fellow citizens who are persons of consensus with the structure and integrity to steer this process.
President Kiir did not elaborate on who selected the persons of consensus and integrity, nor did he name the people steering the process. But Mr. Kiir insists it will involve grassroots consultations, regional peace conferences, and a national conference in Juba. Faith-based groups and local think tanks such as the Sud Institute, the Ebony Center for Strategic Studies, and the Juba University Center for Peace and Development Studies are to be involved in the planning process, according to the president. Mr. Kiir said, the government will guarantee the safety and freedom of all actors who participate in the national dialogue, including those out of the country who oppose his government.
I call upon those who are still carrying arms to stop destroying their own homes and their own country and join the process of national dialogue. I also call upon our national army and all the security organs to uphold their constitutional mandate to protect all the citizens and their property. I promise that no grievances will be left unaddressed in this process.
The president also warned against the hate speech, saying his government will take serious measures against individuals who promote ethnic hatred and violence.
I also call upon those propagating hate speeches in the social media, international and local forums to stop tearing their country and communities apart. We are bound together as one people, one nation, and we cannot allow our political and social disappointments to destroy our country, our unity.
And President Kiir instructed South Sudanese people to, as he put it, stop any propaganda against the international community, especially the American people and the United Nations. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
Thank you, Tito. Ugandan authorities say tension is growing among South Sudanese refugees. They say there's been some violence between the Dinka and Nuer, who are living in camps after fleeing their homeland. Reporter Catherine Nambi has the story.
The Dinka support President Salva Kiir, while the Nuer lean towards former Vice President Riek Machar. Gilbert Olanya, a member of parliament from Amuro district that hosts some of these refugees, says the two tribes are oftentimes seen provoking each other.
What is making us so annoyed and so worried is that the differences they are having in their country between Dinka and the Nuer, they have brought that differences inside Uganda. As I talk now, if a Dinka meets a Nuer, you see them quarreling, you see them fighting. So our major concern as Uganda, we know all of them as refugees from Southern Sudan. They must not bring their differences of tribal conflict inside Uganda.
Uganda Police Force has resorted to the use of community policing in the camps and refugee host communities to help create harmony. Patrick Jimmy Okema is the Uganda Police spokesperson, Aswa region that hosts majority refugees.
We very much know that the best means of handling situations nowadays is community policing. We get some of these people who know, who understand their language. We talk to them. We have a team from Marua, West Nile. We have this people of UNHCR. We have Red Cross. We have Office of the Prime Minister. Ourselves as police, we are on the ground to see that we talk to these people. Others do not know why they've run away from their country. Much as they know there is war there, but they do not know exactly why they came. So that is one thing among other things that we are sharing to them, so that they exactly know what is happening. And we expect them to follow the norms and the rules that we have in Uganda in terms of the constitution, because they are part of us now. Since the government is well clear and interested to look after them.
Josephine Angushia, another police officer in the region, says they will not tire of preaching coexistence between the tribes.
We have also been emphasizing to them that they should leave their conflicts in Sudan. They should leave their intertribal conflicts in Sudan. Here, all of them are considered as the same, who have sought refuge because of a common problem. So to treat each other as brothers and sisters on Ugandan soil, that is what we are trying to do.
She says Uganda's Office of the Prime Minister and UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, have separated the two tribes into different camps. The Dinka have been resettled in Rhino Camp, while the Nuer are in Mvempi settlement. David Kazungu, the Commissioner for Refugees in Uganda's Office of the Prime Minister, warns that any South Sudan refugee caught fighting or destabilizing the camps will be punished according to Uganda's laws.
All the laws that govern security of Ugandans apply to the refugees. No refugees above the law, no refugees allowed to commit crimes, so they have to be charged according to the laws of Uganda. They are our guests here and they have to be governed by the laws of Uganda.
Meanwhile, the South Sudan community in the camps have mobilized themselves into a church whose message is peace and unity. The church is headed by Reverend Abraham Abik Arok from East Jonglei State in South Sudan.
I come and apply to my people. So my people, we sit down and we say we cannot get anything anywhere except we help ourselves. Now we don't have a place for prayer. Let us start contribute until the church stands. In fact, this church is changing a lot because when the church stands, we sit and have a meeting. We start encourage our people to make a unity. It is become a place for peace.
Fighting between the Dinka and Nuer tribes has been at the center of the conflicts in the youngest African nation, South Sudan. For VOA, this is Catherine Nambi reporting from Kampala, Uganda.
The Islamic State yesterday claimed responsibility for Sunday's suicide bombing of a Coptic Christian church in Cairo. The blast at St. Mark's Cathedral killed 25 people. Four people have been arrested in connection to the assault so far. Last Friday, another terror attack in western Cairo targeted a police checkpoint, killing six people. The militant group known as the Hassam Movement claimed responsibility. Analysts say the attacks in Cairo indicate a shift by militant groups who've concentrated on military targets in the Sinai. To learn more, VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi spoke with Ambassador Alberto Fernandez, former director of the State Department's Center for Strategic Counterterrorism Communications.
Well, this has been a long-standing desire of the terrorists in Sinai and the periphery to expand their efforts to the Nile Valley. So it's been something that they've been trying. And, you know, there have been individual assassinations and kidnappings and small-scale efforts. So this represents, obviously, the next step for them and to try to expand their terrorist insurgency into the more populated parts of Egypt. Kind of hearkening back to the situation 20 years ago when there was a much more violent insurgency in those parts of Egypt.
Does the success of terrorists to hit inside Cairo reflect lack of effectiveness of the state mechanisms in facing terrorism?
Probably what it does more than lack of effectiveness of the government is the fact that the terrorists are constantly trying. Sooner or later, they're going to succeed. So you've seen repeated efforts, and some of them have failed, and now, unfortunately, some big ones have succeeded. They've been trying for a while now.
So far, Egyptian authorities are dealing with terrorist attacks with security tools alone. Is that enough?
It isn't enough. There's a problem. For example, when you talk about violence against Coptic Christians, there's a problem in Egypt, and that is a view among some people that is bigoted towards the other, towards religious minorities. And this kind of Islamist worldview of infidels or polytheists or whatever serves as a kind of laboratory or incubation stage for the violence of the jihadists. So the problem of prejudice, the problem of lack of unity, of sectarianism is a problem in Egypt, even beyond the terrorism that we saw in the last few days.
What do you recommend as a comprehensive, cohesive strategy to counter terrorism in Egypt?
Well, one of the things is to follow up on what President Assisi has talked about on several occasions, which is a kind of worldview that is more inclusive of the other, that promotes tolerance, that promotes social harmony. People who can talk about kind of a reformist, enlightened view of Islam an enlightened view of Egyptian society that brings people together rather than separates them and promotes sectarian violence. I mean, there needs to be more openness across the board in Egypt, and it's not just the sectarian issue, but it's the issue of political space, and that is more political space is needed. It shouldn't be that security alone balances out the space that people need to speak out. It doesn't mean you need to give a stage for extremists, but certainly allowing civil society, voices of tolerance, voices of inclusion, is a good thing and strengthens the society.
That's Ambassador Alberto Fernandez, former director of the State Department Center for Strategic Counterterrorism Communications. He spoke to VOA's Mohammed El Shenawy.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Swuhib, and at 21 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. West African leaders will meet Saturday on Gambia's election crisis. South Sudan President Salva Kiir has issued a qualified apology to the Sudanese people. And the Islamic State has claimed the responsibility for Sunday's suicide bombing of a Coptic Christian church in Cairo. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
French authorities have completed a wall in Calais, France. They say it will stop migrants from jumping onto trucks in their effort to cross the English Channel into the United Kingdom. The concrete structure, which is 4 meters or 13 feet high, cost $20 million to build. It was funded by Britain. However, many say the wall was not needed. That's because most of the migrants have already been dispersed throughout France. Reporter Catherine Field spoke with me from Paris about the wall, as well as other migrant developments in France.
The wall was put up at an enormous cost. It cost about $20 million US dollars to put up. It's about 4 meters high, a kilometer long, and it goes on both sides of the main road that links Calais port with the motorway. Now, it was along this particular stretch of road that most of the trucks that were heading towards those ports were ambushed by migrants hoping to get onto the trucks and get to the United Kingdom. Putting up this wall was seen as one of the major, if you like, security measures that the French and the British authorities felt was necessary. Since the Calais camp was dismantled at the end of October, there have been barely any incursions into that area by migrants. So the question has been, why spend so much money on a wall when, in fact, the migrants had already been moved away? The French government is saying, look, this has to stay. Everything has to be ready in case there are any more future mass movements of migrants across Europe and up to that channel port.
In addition to this situation, I understand that there are still many unaccompanied children there. So what is their situation and how is France handling this problem?
Back in October, end of October, beginning of November, the French authorities moved some 5,000 adult migrants and about 1,500 unaccompanied minors out of that Calais camp and sent them to different camps all around the country. And it was said that there they would have all their papers processed, everything will be done to make sure they got moved on. Particular concern was these unaccompanied minors, these children all aged under 18. The British government said they would take some. The Irish government said they would take some as well. Now, it seems this whole process has been going awfully slowly. An official from the Irish government was here in Paris last week talking to the government to try and get the paperwork through to figure out who it should be. But essentially, we're looking at still in these camps, there are young children, mostly from Afghanistan, Somalia, and Eritrea, who are still in these camps all this time later.
How long do you anticipate that they will be there before they are placed?
It's a difficult question. Really, they've been pushed from pillar to post. The original plan was that within a month they would be moved on. Certainly the French have said they want to see everyone moved on by the end of the year. Now, that's clearly not going to happen. They're not going to have 1,500 unaccompanied minors moved off in that time. So we're looking at something that could be stretching well into next year, because the sort of paperwork they're looking at is they have to categorize them into who are really unaccompanied minors, children who have lost their whole family along the way and have absolutely nothing. You then have another group of unaccompanied minors who have some sort of relative in the United Kingdom, you know, a cousin, a second cousin, an uncle, you're particularly in London. Getting all that paperwork, it seems, is proving to be difficult. And of course, with so many having to be processed through so many different countries, it's proving really a bigger job than I think the French authorities thought it would be.
And on the other side of that, are the families trying to look for them?
We're hearing that on both sides, particularly from the United Kingdom, you've got people that know they have relatives somewhere around in France who are going to the British authorities and saying, listen, I know my relative is there. Please, can you help? And because these youngsters have been moved out of the Calais camp and they're distributed in camps right across France, and they're okay camps. So they're in special areas, as some of them are in holiday camp facilities where they're being looked after. It's sort of a feeling that now that they're out of the squalor of the Calais camp and away from the media attention, there is a risk that they're being forgotten.
What are NGOs saying about France in terms of them not acting fast enough and getting some of these situations resolved?
They're getting particularly angry because this is not a new situation. The situation has been going on now since May of this year. So they're saying, look, there's only so much that we can do, but they do keep lobbying and they're starting to lose their patience. Also, the other thing is they feel particularly the British government isn't keeping their side of the bargain. The British government said that they would send officials quickly to each of these camps in France. It seems that they're not sending as many officials as they said they would, and some of the officials don't speak the right languages that is needed for these cases.
That was reporter Catherine Field. She spoke with me from Rome.
A Zimbabwe local government minister says 31 people have died in 13 schools and 400 homes have been destroyed in recent La Nina flooding. Savaur Kasukweri cited the districts of Mangwe, Bulilima, Guruvi, and Nkoyi as among the most affected areas. The government has warned the public to be on high alert for flash floods this summer season. The minister says the victims had received various forms of help and that 4% of the country was exposed to extreme flood hazard. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sali coming up at 18:30 UTC. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Kwame Afori, and our engineer, Rob McLean, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.
Music time in Africa. Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Friday at 0900 and Saturday and Sunday at 0900, 15, 20, and 2200 hours UTC.
When news breaks, VOA News is there.
VOA.
Around the clock, listen to VOA newscasts on the top of each hour, along with our detailed news shows and analysis.
VOA News. We're online at voanews.com.
At voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.